Good day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. So there's a really important narrative about who we are and where we're from here in Southeast Michigan, and it goes something like this. We are literally up south, a term that you often hear African-Americans use to describe Detroit, but one that says a lot about so many of us, black, white, and other, whose families came here in the early to mid parts of the 20th century. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, grandmothers and great-grandmothers came to Michigan from Appalachia, from the Deep South, from the deep, deep South, by the hundreds of thousands, and helped swell the city's population to nearly 2 million by 1960. The reasons to come north were somewhat different for everyone, and kind of depending on who you were. Certainly everybody was lured by the promise of better economic opportunity, and we always talk about Henry Ford's $5 day and the absolute attraction that it had, especially for white migrants coming from the South. African Americans, of course, also believed they were escaping the old South, which still worshipped and enforced inequality across the board. Regardless, though, the ties between Detroit and Detroiters and cities and towns all across parts of the South is really strong even today. Think about our food or our music, our culture, all of it that grew so precipitously during the 20th century. Much of it comes directly from the places we're from. It comes from the South. And so for many of us, there are still really strong ties with places down south. There's rich family history. There are trips that we remember or still take, and powerful memories that reach back generations. A new book, South to America, describes the South in a way that clarifies the lens that those of us whose families left the South use to understand it. It discusses the region's nuances and highlights the false narratives that we sometimes espouse about the South and its people. Imani Perry is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and in South to America, she writes of so many places in an attempt to cover its complexity, its beauty, the contradictions, and, of course, the endless tragedy wrapped up in it all, bound in our country as a whole. Professor Perry is with us today to talk about this and more, and I could not be more excited for this conversation. Professor Perry, welcome to Detroit Today.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for that gorgeous introduction. So happy to talk to you.
So I ask people this question almost always, authors, to start off conversations. Tell me what inspired you to write this book and what inspired you to write it now? Why is this an important story for us to be thinking about?
Well, I mean, of course, in some ways it's particularly timely as we are facing a kind of revival of the culture wars and a really sort of strong anti-democratic push in this nation, much of it that seems to find its center of gravity in the South. But to be honest, I wasn't thinking of the moment as much when I wrote the book. It was in some ways a book that has been percolating for the entirety of my life inside me as someone who is just, you know, who was born in Alabama and raised in Massachusetts and spent summers both in the Midwest in Chicago and in Alabama, and feeling as though over the entirety of my life, there was this sort of profound misapprehension, misunderstanding of the South, and also a kind of diminishment of it that became more acute. I had my understanding became even more acute as I became a student of American history and then a scholar, that people really don't get how important this region was and is, and how it still moves us all about.
So tell me, from your perspective, What is the South, and what does the region and its taste, its textures, its history, what does it tell us about ourselves, first as Americans, but then we'll get to the kind of subcategories of Americans and how it might be different. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, so if we start sort of in the beginning, and there's multiple potential beginnings, right, we can start with the first European encounter with what would become the Americas. We can start with, you know, in 1492, 1520, 1619 with the British. That wherever we start, it starts in the South. And the ways that were said at that moment are really instructive for, you know, on the one hand, there's this discovery, there's this innovation, there's this imagination. On the other hand, lots of people were pushed out and killed and enslaved and dominated in the service of, you know, frankly, nothing less than greed. You know, really this idea that, oh, this land, it's so abundant. What can it yield? How much can be earned from it? And so that dynamic, right, the idea, the imagination combined with a willingness to destroy people's lives, frankly, in the service of that imagination and that desire and that greed, really tells us so much about why we can't, we have yet to achieve the aspirations, you know, of liberty and justice for all, right? It's too easy in this society to be willing to sacrifice people in the service of our aspirations. So that's a piece of it. But then also, because of that, you know, the various people on the underside, you know, the poor, the indigenous, the enslaved, the Jim Crowed, you know, the laborers have given birth to such important culture and freedom dreams. So the fact that American music comes out of the South is not incidental, right? This sort of the plaintive yearning, right? The imagination for what freedom could be. It emerges from there as well, right? So that seeking, that dreaming on both sides really comes out of the South. And I just want to say really quickly, I love the way that you mentioned that it is both white Southerners and Black Southerners who migrate, right? People, so that Southern culture really does become national in a way that I think often people only think of that in terms of Black people, but it's pretty much across the board, right? Southern culture seeps into every corner of this nation.
Yeah. So this difference, though, I think in the way that we experience the South, and certainly in the ways that we experience our connections to the South, is pretty important too. And as you were saying, here in Metro Detroit, you're just as likely to come across a white person who can tell you really rich stories about their family's journey north, mostly those involve, you know, the auto industry and its incredible economic lure, as you are to talk to a Black person who can tell you about, you know, their family coming north. They are similar stories, but they have really different dimensions. Because they're American, right? I mean, they're different stories. Yeah.
They're different stories. And I do, you know, it's really interesting because the South has sort of functions as the repository for the nation's sins, which is part of what I'm arguing in the book, is that instead of understanding that the South sets the terms, people say, oh, that's the sort of backwards place where people do bad things, which is fictional, right? Mm-hmm. Because with respect, you know, racism and economic inequality and oppression of various sorts happens all across the country. But it also, I think, you know, my sense is that there is a kind of much more robust kind of romantic association for Black people who don't live in the South, whose families migrated, with that connection than there is for white Americans. I think there's this often a desire to kind of leave the sort of shame of the white South behind. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, there's such a sort of horrific history of racial violence in the Midwest, in fact, that pretending to leave that behind actually suggests that people shouldn't confront what is right, you know, what happened in that place. You know, there's no, you know, that tradition is strong in the Midwest, you know, for lack of a better word. But yeah, they're different histories, but It is a way of understanding how deeply intertwined we are, right? There's a common culture there, even with all the anguish. And there's an intimacy that took place across the boundaries of the color line that shapes who we are, that I think is also worth acknowledging, even, you know, alongside, obviously, the pain.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with Imani Perry. She is a professor of African-American Studies, the Hughes Rogers Professor of African-American Studies at Princeton University, author of the book South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. We're talking about the South, the American South, the way we see the South, especially as Detroiters and Metro Detroiters, the familiarity that all of us, I think, really have with the South through the roots that we have there. We want to hear from you, the listeners, during this conversation as well. Do you have a connection to the South? Do you have a kinship with particular places in the South that your family hails from and maybe you've visited and maybe even gone to learn more about who you are and where you're from? Give us a call. Let us know about those connections and how you kind of process those connections. Is it something you see as a point of pride, as a point of historical pain or difficulty? How do you make sense of the connection to a place that has such a complicated and nuanced history? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to social media, to Facebook or to Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. Professor Perry, before we get to listeners, I do want to talk a little more about that intertwining that you were just referencing. There's a lot of this in the book. And in some ways, one of the things I really enjoyed about it is the way that you take that intertwining and pull other dynamics out of it. And one of them is the contradiction of whiteness. And you talk a lot about that in your chapter on West Virginia, which I think is one of the most critical places for that question in our country and in this region. I mean, the number of people here in Metro Detroit whose families come from West Virginia is off the charts. So tell the horrifying and really bewildering story of George, who was a slave of Lilburn Lewis.
Yeah. I mean, so this is, you know, he was a child, teenager, broke a vase that was, you know, that was cherished in the household and was massacred. You know, I mean, just, you know, was killed in an incredibly violent fashion as a result of breaking this vase. And other enslaved people were called to bury him. And then there were a series of earthquakes and parts of his body kept coming up. You know, they tried to burn him. They tried to bury, you know, all these things. And it is one of those stories that feels, you know, fairly biblical in the way that this effort to suppress, you know, this absolute, you know, savage violence kept coming up. You know, there was, and ultimately, you know, the Lewises wound up disappearing because for gentlemen, this was sort of a shameful thing to have done this such sort of horrific violence, even to an enslaved person. But it's such an instructive story because we forget, you know, we tell the stories of West Virginia and miners and laboring people, and we forget often, I think, the elites that both moved around, you know, laboring white people and Black people. You know, that Blackness was sort of subject to a kind of violence and disregard that was incomparable, but also white people were exploited laborers. West Virginia still has it's the whitest Southern state. It has incredibly, you know, bad outcomes for residents of the state because of the inequality. And the way that Black and white people, of course, were separated, you know, laboring people, oppressed peoples, of course, through the idea of race. But I wanted to delve into the history of the state to understand that there were layers of the ways in which people were disenfranchised, working people, people who went deep down into the earth to provide abundance for this nation, right? Like the things, our modern conveniences are possible because people went deep down into the earth and suffered physically, emotionally, and for us, right? And I want, you know, so to uncover that history to me seems to sort of try to get past sort of the romantic myth and think about how this place was made, right? Mm. Across the board, with some care.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't help but read that chapter on West Virginia and not think of modern West Virginia and the stories we are talking about now.
I mean,
this incredible struggle that that Joe Manchin goes through a daily basis. I feel like, and look, I'm not sympathetic to him in many ways for some of the ways that he plays that, but I am, I think, empathetic to the push and pull in that state, which I don't know that most people who live there now would describe it as having its roots in this kind of racial inequality as well as economic inequality.
But
it does. It absolutely is cast forward into 2022.
Absolutely. And those who own the, you know, there's a kind of Manchin is sort of in many ways a sort of contemporary coal baron in there. And we see that tension between that sort of mode of wealth production and the democratic sensibilities of West Virginians, which are very complex, right? The intersection between like this labor history and this racial history means that its politics are really distinctive, but so illuminating.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this really wonderful conversation with Imani Perry about her book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. We will get to you on the phones and on social media. If you want to join us, give us a call, 313-577-1019. Talk about your relationship to the South. Talk about how you think of the South. How do you think of the history that your family might have in the South? So many of us here in Southeast Michigan do have those connections. You can also go to social media, Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Our guest this hour is Professor Imani Perry. She is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the book South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. We're talking about the relationship between the South and the rest of America, the relationships that those of us here in Southeast Michigan so often have to the South, the place where so many of our families came from, to this city in the 20th century. We want to hear from you about your connections to the South, your thoughts about the South. Call and tell us, is this a place that you visited as a child to go back to where your family was from? What do you make of the places that you know in the South and about how history shapes what they are today, how they connect to our lives here in Southeast Michigan, our food, our culture, our music. Think of what Motown would not have been, perhaps, if we had not had this influx of African-Americans from South to North. Give us a call, 313-577-1019. Is the number on the phones, 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Let's start today with Nancy in Dearborn. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stephen, and thank you so much for having this topic. I've been many of my days thinking about this very thing because my roots are deep into Alabama, and I was a military child, so we moved around a lot, and I've ended up in the Dearborn area in Dearborn, Detroit, as a professor or teacher, and am about to consider moving down there with trepidation, but also with love. My family history goes deep, and I've written about it, and I think I saw social justice inclinations in my father generations, or I'm sorry, decades ago. I am proud to claim Doug Jones as a voice of goodness out of the state. I am proud that Alabama now has its first black poet laureate, Ashley Jones. There are many things, but those things don't make, quote, the news. And my decision, of course, is to whether my progressive soul would be able to stay there and be there and make a change. So there's much more to say, but I'll stop at that.
So, Nancy, I love that you called, and I love that you're thinking of going back to Alabama.
Yes.
It's something that I think all of us who have roots there kind of toy with every once in a while. But Nancy, before I get back to our guest, can you tell me just a little about that, the pull to go back and what you hope to do if you do?
Oh, that's such a good question. Do you have an hour? No. Is that you? And I have spoken briefly when you were at First UU Detroit. I've been writing about this. I started writing about my roots about 10 years ago. And as I wrote and went down and researched, I felt the pull. And I felt the need to clarify for myself what all of it meant. And as I've gone down more and more, I just came back last month from a month in Alabama to try to see how I felt about it, and I actually felt pretty good.
Wow.
But then I look at the tweets from the Alabama governor, and that sends me out the back door.
Yeah.
So the draw is bloodline family. It's also a desire, a strong desire, to say, can we all figure this out together? Can you understand that I'm a white woman, a baby boomer from Alabama, and that I do care, and I want to help, and I want to know what to do, and tell me what to do? And so that's where I am with it. I've got every friend I have in Alabama is progressive and open-hearted. And that's amazing to some people.
That is kind of amazing to think about. Nancy, I'm so glad you called and shared that story. Professor Perry, that right there, Nancy's pull the lure back is something that I think is also fascinating. You have that same dynamic in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I was born in Alabama, and most of my family continues to live in Alabama. And before COVID, I went there probably four times a year. You know, want my children to be deeply connected. So I understand that pull. There is a kind of grace in everyday living, a kind of gentleness and kindness in the way people interact with each other. And I will say that it's very easy for me to connect to Detroiters because so much of Detroit culture is directly connected to Alabama. I mean, that's the prime, right? And even the intersection between Appalachia and Alabama, you know, my ancestors come from Northern Alabama, which is sort of the foothills of Appalachia. So there's it's a very comfortable connection. I will say that I think part of the history, and I write about white Alabamans who were in the civil rights movement in the book. And part of the difficulty, I think, for progressive, politically progressives, white Americans in Alabama is that there is a disciplining, like a kind of punishment, I think, that politically progressive white people feel in a place like Alabama that is so conservative. And part of what I wanted to do was give voice to that, because it's not to suggest that, oh, well, it's harder for them than it is for people of color, but it is important to think about, right, the way in which pressure can shape people's politics and actually can alienate and isolate people in a context that tends to be sort of racially divided. So it's so wonderful to hear that so much of, you know, her community in Alabama is like-minded, right? Yeah. I think it's a good thing. And it's important to nurture those communities in the South.
And it's important to note that the South is changing really dramatically right now. And it's not just, you know, Alabama and politics. It's culture and demographics and all kinds of things all the way across the South. It is not the place that it was just 20 years ago. And Nancy's stories about this kind of progressive thought and community, the election of Doug Jones, the elections of Warnock and now I'm going to forget the other senator from Georgia.
Oh, Georgia.
I mean, it's astonishing, right?
Yeah. Although Georgia and Alabama are very much different.
Yes. You know? Yes.
I mean, Georgia is a much. I mean, I think that the tricky thing is it's changing, but it's also the changing same. So we're both seeing a transformation around all sorts of issues, race, sexuality, gender politics, you know, immigration is changing the demographics, and there's a very intense backlash happening. Mm-hmm, and the question is how those of us who are in the South or connected to the South, how will we meet the backlash, right? So there's a transformation, but there's also a really important, I don't know what the language would be, battle that's an old battle that's being waged about who counts, right? Mm-hmm. Are we going to, is every human being in this place, are we going to treat them with respect and recognize their dignity and include them? And that is an important thing to be part of, I think, you know, so it's transformation, but it's transformation that is only sustainable with participation and civic engagement.
Yeah. Nancy, again, really appreciate the call and you sharing your story, and good luck as you make decisions about whether to go back home. Let's next go to Kelly on the East Side. Kelly, what's on your mind?
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find this conversation fascinating because I've always found the Southern to Northern migration in America fascinating, and I'm really glad we now have somebody writing, you know, such a great book. I intend to buy this book. My father's family moved from Tennessee up to Lansing when he was first born. He's a baby boomer to work in the car factories. Mm-hmm. And but before they came, they had been farmers in Tennessee. And before that, they were loggers. The first immigrants were loggers in the Appalachian Hills. Whereas my mother's people settled in Michigan a long time ago and just never really left. So I do feel incredibly divided. I consider myself a Northerner, a Yankee, I guess. I've only ever visited my Tennessee side of my family twice in my life, and it was in the 80s. So I don't have a relationship. They feel like foreigners to me. And when I did interact with them, it felt very different. And the whole idea, I appreciated, you know, that I'm sorry that her name is escaping my brain right now, brought up earlier in the conversation about the labor of the white people in the hills and in the farms and the exploitation. But it still didn't sit well with some of the behavior I saw when we did go and visit as if, you know, from them. So I guess I do feel that divide, and I do feel that, now a Detroiter or a Michigander, you know, I've ever known integration. So.
Yeah. Right. Kelly, I really appreciate that perspective because, I think for a lot of us who have roots in the South, there is this difficulty that we face reckoning with what that history is for white Americans. I think a lot of it is, you know, connections to the system of inequality that, you know, has had hold of not just the South but the entire country since its beginning. But for African Americans, there's also this reckoning with pain, I think, and difficulty and some forms of shame about where you're from and what your family might have endured. Professor Perry, that duality, I think, is part of the relationship too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. One of the things I think it's really important to, and it's more evident with white Americans who migrated from the South, but that everybody left largely because of work, right? So there are these narratives about Black people escaping, you know, Jim Crow and racial violence. And while that is a thread, it's the boll weevil that really precipitates migration for African Americans. And it's always been the case, and people don't know this, but the majority of African Americans continue to live in the South, have always lived in the South, right? So the Great Migration is massive, but most Black people stayed. I think the thing that is tricky about some of the framing, though, of like sort of the South sort of escaping, you know, the racial logics of the South for white Americans is that, you know, there really was so much racial violence in Detroit and you know, the surrounding suburbs. I mean, in many ways, mob violence unlike that had ever been seen in the South in the mid 20th century. And then there's also the piece that is, you know, and one of my best interlocutors for the book was Dr. Walter Evans, who was a physician, a surgeon in Detroit for many, many years, who was from Savannah and returned. And even he talks about being in Detroit, and he was a successful surgeon and a Black man, but white flight and the segregation that exists in Detroit, right, as framing his experience and actually experiencing in some ways in the South is actually not as racially hostile. So I think we have to sort of push some of the ways that we assume things are. And also with the sort of culture of explicit racism in Appalachia, being clear that for some white Americans, and this is not an excuse, but rather an explanation, whiteness is the only thing they had, right? I mean, so that becomes something that is people clung to desperately because of how debased and how inferior they were seen amongst white Americans. So this doesn't justify it, but it's important to understand that someone else may decide I'm moving because there are too many Black people around here and never say a racist word. And someone may say a racist word, but not be able to move away from Black people, right? Like that those aren't necessarily different things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, coming up, we're going to continue this conversation with Professor Imani Perry of Princeton University about her book, South to America. We'll also continue to hear from you on the phones and on social media. And if you want to join us, again, give us a call, 313-577-1019. Tell us about your connections to the South, your memories, or your thoughts about the South and what it means. What it means in your life, what it means in your family. You can also go to social media, Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and we can include you in the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Our guest this hour is Professor Imani Perry. She is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. We're talking about the South and its powerful connections to the rest of our nation, and especially to us here in Southeast Michigan, in Detroit and our suburbs. So many of us have family connections to the South, have memories of the South, have cultural connections to the South. Call and tell us what those are for you. What are the touchstones in your life that you relate to your family's history in the South? As always, the number on the phones here is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there. Or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. I want to start this part of the conversation talking about my own connection to the South. And of course, I've got like everybody, I have two different families that ended up coming north to Michigan, but my dad's family and his journey has been the one that's been most interesting to me, and it's because it's the one I know the least about or knew the least about growing up. And I spent 30 years as an adult not having anything to do with those roots. My dad died when I was 14, and I was 44 when I finally went back to Natchez, Mississippi, which is where he's from, to start just kind of reacquainting myself with him and his family. But also, what I've found, of course, is a really complicated and really rich history. And I don't think any African-American can make that journey and get much further than the first journey to the Hall of Records or to a cemetery and not bump up against the history of slavery. Because as much as I think as Americans we'd like to think that's ancient history, it really just isn't. I mean, it's only a few generations back in all of our families. And the difficulty of reckoning with that, especially when you don't have, your family to kind of explain it, is something that's been really, really intriguing to me to experience as an adult. That it's not just like digging in the dirt of the past. It's like it is digging inside of ourselves and trying to understand really complex things. I mean, one of the things that I've bumped up against really quickly is the notion that I'm related not only to enslaved people, but in almost certain probability, also enslavers. And that complication, I think, sometimes turns us off from that kind of exploration. But in the book, I think you do such a wonderful job of trying to I guess it's maybe a course pack, right? for doing that in a way that doesn't inspire such negative feelings, that doesn't inspire shame, but inspires a thirst for understanding. And it reminds me of how little so many of us actually understand. I mean, I am confessing to my own ignorance here over 30 years and the last several years of trying to be more knowledgeable. But I think that's pretty common. And I think that fear is one of the things that holds us back.
Yeah, that's so, I think that's true. And one of my struggles with the genealogical piece is that I do, I do genealogy in the book, and I think it's important. And it is for most of us as Black Americans who do genealogy, we will find a significant amount of European ancestry, which means that our ancestors were most likely victims of the institutionalized rape of the slave society, right?
Yes.
And I mean that, and this is really important because people ask this question about consent, and you have to remember that an enslaved person really couldn't consent because they couldn't say no, right? So irrespective of whether there were relationships of sort of the most brutal form of rape or the sort of coercive rape, either way, right? That is a central part of our history, and lots of our women ancestors experienced it. That's part of the story. And also part of the story is that many of our ancestors, most, were not documented by name. If they were documented by name, it was because they were in wills and being willed to people, but their births and deaths were not recorded. And so for me, as someone who is able to trace back to the early 1700s, knowing that for many African Americans pre-1870, it's not going to happen. I want us to be very clear in understanding that even if you can't, that all of the history belongs to all of us. Even if we can't trace individual histories, we can learn something from the stories broadly of how Black people endured and imagined and escaped and all those things. That I want us to have a broad sense of it belonging to all of us, much in the same way that you know, our ancestors came from so many different African cultures. We mm-hmm. have pieces of all of those cultures. We don't have a single culture. We have pieces of all those cultures, all the European cultures, the indigenous ancestry. We are by definition a mixed race and a multicultural people who became something on these shores out of the devastation of the transatlantic slave trade.
Yeah. Big Neo on Twitter writes, I wish I was able to participate in a conversation like this, but my family has a propensity to not share those oral histories. Unfortunately, that leaves me not knowing my family roots. This is exactly what we're talking about right here is for so many of us, you've got to kind of proactively
get to dig around.
Yeah, right. You got to go really and do it yourself. Yeah. And it's not as hard anymore. Of course, we've got all these wonderful tools. Through technology that didn't exist even a decade ago to be able to do it. So
can I say share a story related to that? Because I have one side of my family tree that I don't really know. And I was through Ancestry was digging around and found this ancestral cousin who almost has the exact same face as me. And it's a sort of like, my son, I actually put a picture of her on the wall. My son was like, take that down. It's creepy to see this 1920 picture of someone. Like, but I mean, I think that there's, you know, we have to be able to quilt our way to making a sense of our story. And even the silences are important to acknowledge, you know, that there's some, you know, that there are things, you know, Toni Morrison does this beautifully in the novel Beloved, which ends with these lines, this was not a story to pass on. And even the refusal to passing on is something that is historically significant. So I do encourage people to dig around, but also to think about what it meant to not want to give you the burden of certain histories, right? That's meaningful too.
Yeah. Yeah. That story about your cousin who looks like you reminds me of the moment in Natchez when I walked into the summer home of the family that I'm pretty sure owned mine. And they had a portrait on the wall of the slaveholder who founded all of what they had. And if you had made him, I don't know, a few shades darker, he would have been my grandfather.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, the likeness was just, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. Now, that's not a picture I'm going to hang in my house.
No, not that one.
But it's a reminder of where we all kind of come from. Again, Big Neo. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and Natchez has such an extraordinary cultural history, right? Which is also something that belongs to you, right? I mean, it's it's a remarkable place and a painful place.
It is. It absolutely is. Let's go back to the phones here. Yolanda in Detroit. Yolanda, what's on your mind?
Hi, Stephen. I love your program. Been a long time follower.
Thank you.
My accidental history involves Fort Pillow. My great-grandfather was one of the few survivors. And it was only until about 2006 that we found him.
Wow.
And I'm in Tennessee right now because the massacre occurred on April 12th of 1864.
Okay.
And descendants come every year for the last 15 years to memorialize and commemorate this massacre, where out of 600 Union troops, only over 50% were killed. Women, children, soldiers, black and white, majority of them were black, formerly enslaved people. And it's kind of traumatic because the state of Tennessee doesn't know how to handle this history.
Sure.
And the descendants are from all over. I'm from Detroit. My dad was raised in Memphis, and he didn't even realize that he had a grandfather who was one of the survivors. So this is what we do every year. There was a bill introduced three times trying to make this site a national monument in a battlefield memorial that has not passed because some of the legislatures here in Tennessee will not recognize this site.
Wow.
And people just don't know how to handle the history. It's all about the perpetrator of who caused the massacre. but there's no focus on the victims.
On the victims.
And my cousins who live in Memphis, they very seldom attend because they say they have to live here. Yeah. Bringing up this past horrible incident of a massacre on Tennessee soil is kind of traumatic for them. And they have to get up every day, go to work, and interact with other people. And if you bring up the Fort Pillow incident, they say, oh, you know, that we got too much to do nowadays because that happened 158 years ago.
Right. Yolanda, I love that you called. And I just want to say the vigilance that you're exercising with other descendants is the thing that matters, and is the way that hopefully you will eventually get the recognition that you want for your ancestors. Professor Perry, I wonder what your reaction is to that story.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's so devastating, and to keep in mind, both that Nathan Bedford Forrest, who is the one who led that massacre, mm-hmm. has been honored all over the South.
I mean, everywhere.
Monuments,
right?
Everywhere.
The schools.
Right. Yeah. And also that the Fort Pillow massacre, part of it was horrific. And also the idea was Confederates didn't take Black prisoners of war. They killed them, Black soldiers, because of thinking that they were not fit to be soldiers, right? So the massacre is both, it's a taking of life that's horrifying, and it's also an assertion that Black people did not count, right? Mm-hmm. That's part of the logic behind it. You are useless in this society, but for the condition of enslavement. It's essentially what the message was. And so it is a particularly horrifying moment in our history. And this is part of why we're battling over how to tell the stories of history now. Because if you don't tell that story, then you evade the long question of how many ways Black people have been kept out of being fully recognized as members of the society, right? You know, if you tell that story, it actually encourages you to think and to look and to pay attention, right, to what remains unfair. If you turn your head away from it, right, it actually, you know, these are the kind of, destructive binders. So I am so appreciative, of the caller and her family for continuing to tell this story and to push for it, because it's important, right? Because it's one of those stories that tells us what this nation is and isn't, right?
Yes.
Important.
Yeah. Yolanda, I'm glad you called, and good luck in Tennessee.
Yes, indeed.
Let's quickly go to Brittany in Van Buren Township. Brittany, I've only got about a minute and a half left, but I wanted to get you in here.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Thank you so much for thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a huge fan. Unfortunately, I didn't hear the entire segment today, but the portion that I did tune in on was a portion on Appalachia, and that immediately hit home for me because I grew up a good portion of my childhood in southern West Virginia. My family down there are Southern Baptists, like the whole deal. I was baptized in a white dress on a river. And speaking to the whiteness in that area, that was like hit the nail on the head. Like, that's all they have. That's all there's so much of nothing there. Well, when I moved down there, my mother started seeing someone who used words and language to talk about Black people that I knew was wrong. And I didn't really understand, because that was the first time I had started hearing this stuff. And the school that I went to didn't have very many Black classmates. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that like those words applied to them. I didn't think those behaviors applied. And it was really confusing because my stepfather, his best friend, one of his very best friends was a Black man. And he would say, he's not those words.
Right.
Those things don't apply to him. And it was very confusing.
Brittany, yeah. I don't mean to cut you off, but we're going to run out of time. And I do want to have Professor Perry react to what you're saying. I've only got about 30 seconds left, though.
Yeah, I just will say quickly, I am so moved by your obvious emotion. And I do think that
you can hear it in her voice.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying speaks to, racism and hatefulness are traumatic and they wound us. They wound us all, not equally. And that, you know, just testifying and you're saying, I knew this wasn't right, and then wanting to seek something different is important. That's important for all of us to do in all of the different forms of bigotry and hatefulness that are exist in the world. And they're not coherent. It don't make sense because they're wrong ways of seeing the world, you know?
Yes, yes. Professor Imani Perry, it was really great to have this conversation with
you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Great talking to you. Take care.
You too. All right, that's going to do it for us this week. I'll be back on Monday when we're going to be talking about the new political fight around abortion that's happening here in Michigan. Governor Gretchen Whitmer trying to overturn the ban on abortion ahead of what might be the Supreme Court striking down Roe v. Wade. Important show on Monday. I'll be here. I hope you will, too. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again next week.